broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne. This is Wilms Front, brought to you by the Unshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this fortnight's edition of Wilms Front, the featured interview show on this Thursday, the 17th of June, 2021. We are live on the show YouTube and DLive channels, as well as on the interactive Entropy software, which they're linked to, where you can ask questions and send through super chats. I've put those in the live discussions there. Hello to everyone in the live chats. It is 8:30 p.m. here in Melbourne, where at 11:59 p.m. tonight, we are going to be moving out of lockdown light, which we have been in for the past week, 3 weeks of lockdown overall, of a 7-day circuit breaker lockdown, we were told. The Andrews Molino government is dripping back some more of our previously existing freedoms. The 25-kilometre travel radius will be abolished, so Victorians can move freely around the state, including to and from Melbourne. Masks will no longer be required in public outdoor settings. 20 people can gather in public, and 2 private visitors are permitted to homes per day. But on the day that Victoria recorded 0 new local cases, up in Sydney, a new cluster or outbreak, whatever you want to call it, from a leak from hotel quarantine has been detected, which currently stands at 3 cases, starting with a Sydney airport transport driver. Though if I were a Sydney-sider, I'd be much less anxious about a potential lockdown, given the New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian has a track record in managing outbreaks. So without going into a full-on lockdown or a circuit breaker lockdown, the vaccine rollout in Australia is in disarray again, with the federal government's vaccine advisory body, ATAGI, now only recommending the AstraZeneca vaccine for those aged over 60. This was after a 52-year-old died from blood clots linked to the AstraZeneca vaccine last week. This leaves the mRNA Pfizer and Moderna vaccines as the only recommended options for Australians under 60, which the federal government is relying on foreign imports for supply to keep up with. But as we have seen with Victoria's latest local COVID case, a vaccinated nurse who has been treating vaccinated COVID patients, this means that the vaccines still don't protect against transmissions, which our governments are around Australia. They're most obsessed with preventing any transmission at all. But the real emergency disaster in Victoria is not actually COVID, but thousands of Victorians who are still without power and will be for another 2 to 3 weeks, also with undrinkable water after last week's wild storms. With more wild weather forecasts, it is still extremely cold and wet here in Victoria. The storms so far have claimed 2 lives and have also led to a spider plague, which we also saw in New South Wales after their storms and flash flooding. The relaxation of restrictions in Victoria will mean that Victoria Police's notorious enforcement of the lockdowns will subside for now. Over the past year, the state of law enforcement, not just here in Victoria, but around the Western world, has been in focus, with critics coming from across the political spectrum. It's certainly not a left-right issue. My guest tonight has been in the front line of law enforcement for over a decade. Evelyn Ray has been a highly competent, honourable and ethical police officer. Evelyn is also a major contributor to the unapologetically Christian conservative website Cauldron Pool. She vlogs regularly on her social media about the cultural issues of the day and has made regular appearances on Pello Talk, InfoWars and Paul Murray Live. It's my pleasure to welcome Evelyn to Wilms Front. Thanks for joining the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tim.
Now, let's start with why you decided to go into policing as a career, because I don't discount for a moment that it's a tough job, you'd have to be alert all the time. I certainly wouldn't ever consider a career in that field. What attracted you to it?
Well, I always make a joke that I think I did it to annoy my parents the most. But my, you know, my family come from emergency services. I grew up with a father who that's all I've known him to be and to do. I kind of branched off into criminal law, was really interested in law. And then I just sort of decided I didn't want to represent criminals. I would rather lock them up than be on that side of it. So that's sort of what led me down that path, I guess.
Now, as I mentioned, policing has become quite a contentious profession. Obviously, people such as yourself, and I'd say the overwhelming majority, well, almost all of police officers join for honourable reasons, the right reasons. As I said, perspectives on police, they differ across the political spectrum. I still consider myself a libertarian at my core, and so I have a natural, I wouldn't say fear, but worry about the power that authority brings. For example, like when I hear police sirens anywhere, like around my property, or when I'm driving, I don't feel safe and secure. I feel worried. I know that I'm not doing anything wrong, but you just feel that, are they coming to question me about something? Is this going to be a terse encounter? That's my immediate reaction when there's police in the area.
Yeah, and that's sadly the current state of where we're at. And, you know, that's sort of part of the reason why I like to speak about it so often as well, because I would like to sort of bridge the gap between law enforcement and civilian. It's hard for me to criticize the police because I lived and breathed it. And there's this like unspoken camaraderie, you know, once you bleed blue, you always bleed blue. And there's something that unless you've done it, it's really hard to understand it. And it's actually a really hard thing to articulate the culture of the police as well. There are a lot of negative aspects of the culture of the police. But look, I'm all for small government. And so this is why I'm so conflicted, because I'm in a position where I'd like to support the police and I would like to be an advocate for them and bridge that gap between law enforcement and civilian. But at the same time, everything in me at the moment is feeling a little disappointed with the things that I'm seeing, like the videos that were coming out of Victoria during the lockdown. And I'm the first to admit that there were things that I was seeing coming out of there that I was shocked by as a former law enforcement officer, and things that I thought, I am so grateful that I am no longer employed in the police, because there are things that they're doing I could not do in good conscience.
That's one of the main reasons why the second half of 2020 was so horrid for many Victorians, because it seemed like every park where you were allowed to go for your 1 hour of exercise, there were swarming police there, making sure you were properly exercising, wearing your mask. And well, we heard from like the police leadership, Shane Patton was came out very aggressively at the beginning of the second lockdown, saying we're fine, these people, they really like make sure you do what you're told. And then it was blown up even further by Assistant Commissioner Luke Cornelius when talking about the Victoria police action in preventing the Freedom Day in September last year, with his comment about tinfoil hat, batshit crazy conspiracy theorists. Which the thing that really I think upset people the most about that, and well, alarmed people, was that he was making a moral judgment on people as well, when, well, it's the role of police to just enforce the law. And he was saying, I don't like these people at all. We're going to crack down on them. And, well, even when lockdown lifted, we saw the horrendous kettling and processing and fining of anti-lockdown protesters on Melbourne Cup Day. We don't know who gave the order or anything like that, and there's still incidents, especially when there's a tightening of restrictions, even if it's not for lockdown. The public order response in metropolitan Melbourne, who are under the command of Luke Cornelius, take quite a proactive role in, well, making sure that it's unpleasant as possible for that, well, to deter people from going by making it an unpleasant environment.
Yeah, and look, I think what you were sort of saying at the start there is just the inconsistencies we saw with policing. On one hand, they were allowing things for the Melbourne Cup and, you know, they were allowing, you know, protests for BLM. This is like way back when it first sort of started.
Yes, and, the first and second wave.
That's right, yeah. And you know, and then a couple of months down the track, you know, people, you know, weren't able to do Anzac Day marches and people weren't able to do other things within like a week or so of other things being allowed. And look, I think, yeah, as I said before, I don't enjoy speaking out against the police because I do think they have a really hard job and they get, you know, they kind of get unfair criticism at times, but I'm all for criticizing how this has all been handled because it's been handled very poorly. And, you know, as I've always said, it starts up the top. And unfortunately, like, you've got to look at the sort of leadership right now that the police would have. And that just sort of filters downhill into the sort of more junior people. But another thing with this type of job, you've got two sorts of people that join. One, you've got people who genuinely want to help and join because they think they can make a difference. And two, you get people who like to join for the wrong reasons because they like the power, they like the authority. And unfortunately, it's a double-edged sword. It comes with the nature of the job. And I think that during the COVID lockdowns, it sort of sifted out maybe the police that should never have joined or who joined for the wrong reasons or who maybe aren't the right people for the job. And I think it's really sorting out the good operators from maybe the poor operators. And, you know, I've said this from the very start, if you want to get rid of 99.9% of these problems and get rid of these bad officers, the whole recruitment process for the police has to be reformed. It has to be different. The recruitment process is shocking. It is terrible. And if it was fixed, if it was amended, and if it was a lot better, then these problems would most likely disappear.
What is the, obviously it's different in each state and territory. They all have their separate police forces, but what is the current recruitment process, training through the academies? Obviously, there's now all these diversity hires and gender hires. I don't think that you would have been a gender hire.
Oh, I was. I'm happy to admit that. I probably was. Yeah.
But you were still suitable for the job, obviously.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, I was 18 when I joined. I had zero life experience. I'm 5'5" and I weigh 60 kilos. Like, I was definitely the quota. And I'm happy to admit that. But I think my service record and everything I did, you know, proved that I, in the end, wasn't the quota. And it's something I'm quite proud of. But that was back in the mid-2000s when I joined. And the fact that it was like that back then, before, you know, this leftist utopia kind of took over these organizations even more so, only goes to show it's probably even worse now. Sadly, I think it is quota over quality these days. And, you know, the recruitment process, back when I joined, I went, you know, to the academy for close to a year. During COVID, they've made them shorter. And I think people are going to the academy for only 3 months now. That's just, I didn't think that 10, 11 months for me was long enough. Like, you know, you're in this little closed environment and then you're thrown in the deep end.
Tended to by a nurse or a doctor who'd had 3 months training.
Yeah, that's right. And this is one of the issues that I had with the whole argument of defund the police, because I thought to myself, every other government organization or any business, if it's failing, what do? The government says, oh, education's failing. Our school kids are dumbing down. We need to, you know, improve our education in Australia. Let's throw more money into this. Let's fund it. Let's get more resources. Let's get better teachers. Let's do this. You name it, any government organization that's failing, that's what they do. But with the police, they're like, they're labeling police as failures and saying, you're failing, but we're actually going to cut your income, which means we're going to have less resources for you, less training. You're going to have less, like, you know, on the job requirements, and we're going to make you even worse. So I never understood that whole debacle with defund the police. I thought it was the most ridiculous idea. And there are a lot of them going around these days.
Well, as I mentioned, the defund the police was born during what, as I term, BLM 2.0, after the death of George Floyd. And it was interesting that we saw, obviously, the Melbourne Black Lives Matter rally was the biggest, and Victoria Police didn't stand in their way. In fact, Luke Cornelius said, we're going to accommodate these protests, even though the gathering limit at the time was 20 even, took the knee for BLM. He actually managed to go down on his knee, do that physical activity there. But it was also interesting the people who, the usual far left activists who organise these types of rallies, how the police were all horrible, racist, brutal then. But during the second lockdown, when Luke Cornelius was attacking people they didn't like, they couldn't get enough of the Victoria police enforcement against COVIDiots. And were a apologetic for everything. They even, until they real, obviously the worst incident of police brutality during the second Victorian lockdown was actually not to do with a political activist. It was that mentally ill man who, because he couldn't get a bed in a mental health ward, had a breakdown. And well, the police ran into him with his car, and there was that officer who stomped on his head. The people who were cheering on the lockdown said, oh, well, he is obviously some sort of protester, so good on the police for doing that until the facts came out. But this is another thing with the, Victoria Police, I'm sure it's the same with, but the internal affairs. This police officer who stomped on his head was suspended with pay pending an investigation. And I'm not sure if you've been following it. It's been going on for 2 or 3 years. And this is the thing, that they're still employed, getting their salary, even if there are these assault allegations. There was this mentally disturbed elderly pensioner who was waterboarded during a welfare check by some Victoria police officers. That's been, justice is slow in the state of Victoria, period, but getting justice against Victoria police is even slow, unless you are a transgender woman like Danny Laidley is, and police leak photos, then Victoria police officers are ordered to pay you thousands of dollars in compensation. It could do to the fact that the person in charge of internal affairs in Victoria, Neil Patterson, is a homosexual. Take, for example, the officers who were around Derek Chauvin when he put the knee on George Floyd's neck. Derek Chauvin and all the other police officers were immediately fired. That was it. Their careers were over, and those involved in other contentious policing incidents in the US were immediately fired or resigned. There was near instant accountability. Obviously, if those firings were, that's a whole other thing, but you see the difference I'm talking about.
Yeah, and look, even though, and I've always said this, even though I'm very pro-police and I like to defend them, I'm also not completely against reformation within the police. There, it is a flawed system, and there are a lot of things, like some things that you mentioned, that I do believe really need to change. And if police want to, you know, have a healthy relationship with the people they're supposed to be protecting, then these things need to happen and need to happen fast, because we're kind of on a trajectory to the sort of hatred that we're seeing from, you know, public towards police that you see in America. So I do think there are a lot of things that need to change. I wish I had the right people's attention to talk to about this, because I have a lot to say on it. But yeah, there's lots of things that would make a huge difference in building back that bridge between, you know, police and civilian. And yeah, things that you mentioned just before would be a great step in that direction if accountability was seen and able to be witnessed. I guess I'm all for, you know, innocent until proven guilty. I think that it's a very regressive sort of mentality to, you know, be guilty on assumption. But like you said, there is some footage that speaks for itself. You know, there's some footage that you see where there's no possible logical or reasonable explanation for those certain behaviours. And I think in those circumstances, yeah, quick, swift action would help alleviate some of the tension between police and, yeah, civilian. But, I think that yeah, a lot needs to change, and I'm happy to sort of admit that. And I'll also say this, that nobody hates bad cops more than good cops. And I've said that a lot, but that is so true. We don't like the bad cops. They make our job a lot harder, because we go to situations and there's that hostile sort of mentality towards us immediately, straight off the bat. The sovereign citizen, you know, God bless their little cotton socks, but they actually make it harder for police to use discretion, because they're recording live, they're doing things. There's just a lot of things at the moment, unfortunately, that kind of fracture the relationship, and it does need to be fixed.
A lot of the you're talking about the filmed interactions that a lot of the anti-lockdown activists have had with, well, local police, especially in Victoria. A lot of it's become memed quite a bit, but the police officers, you know, we're just enforcing the law, following orders, which they term the Nuremberg defense. And going over to the United States, like, for example, the California governor, Gavin Newsom, nicknamed Gruesome Newsom, mandating all sorts of restrictions, but you had local sheriffs there. It's like, I'm not enforcing like a curfew or that thing. But, well, it's not just a Victoria thing, it's also an Australian, and, well, as we've seen over in Canada and the UK there, the police there have just followed the orders no matter what the societal cost there. And also, as a Christian, you must be conflicted with, especially in Canada, all those pastors being arrested, their churches being shut, which Cauldron Pool has covered in various contributors.
Yeah. So I think following orders, like, this is part of the culture that's really hard to articulate. And I would love to somehow figure out a way to write it down so people can kind of consume it and understand it. But there is a mentality within the police that when you're a junior officer, you shut your mouth and you do what you're told. And if you don't, your life is made a living hell. Like, that's just how it is. Whoever is the senior officer on the truck is in charge. Whoever's the senior person there is in charge. And certain people of certain ranks can actually give you directives. So you can perform the physical act of arrest even though you as that particular officer is not arresting them. So you can basically act as like the physical arm piece of another officer sitting back at the station who has said, you need to arrest this person for me and bring them back. So there are complexities involved. Again, like I said before, I am very grateful that I resigned when I did. I just missed out on all of this stuff. I resigned 2020. So I gratefully am out of this because I would be in a situation where I do not believe I would be able to do the things that are being asked of me to do as a police officer. But what I would like to say that is encouraging, New South Wales Police, and I believe there are other police in other states around Australia, are actually suing and looking to sue the government for putting police in this position. So I can send you the link after the show, or I can put it up on my Twitter and people can actually support them. But there were three police that I can think of in New South Wales that actually wrote an official letter to the government saying that they're not going to be participating in enforcing these lockdown laws, that it actually goes against the oath that they swore into office, and that it doesn't fall under part of their duties as a police officer. And they've had thousands of signatures from different police officers around Australia, and in particular New South Wales, sign this petition. And they've actually hired these lawyers, and they're doing like almost like a Supreme Court Royal Commission type inquiry into this. So I'm actually really encouraged that me understanding the culture of the police in Australia in comparison to the culture of the police in America, like you mentioned, this is actually a really big deal for these cops to actually stand up against that. And not only that, they've put their name, their signature to everything, and they've sent it off and made this official process start. So I'm really encouraged by things like that. Yeah, I think that we should shed more light on the good that the good officers are trying to do. But yeah, I'm very glad that I'm not in that position. The situation in Canada, like you mentioned, as a Christian, I obviously, you know, I adhere to the law of the land, unless the law of the land is in direct contradiction to God's law. So for me, for example, I think that the pastors in Canada have completely acted lawfully according to God's law, because while we are required to follow the law of the land, if it does go into direct conflict of God's laws, then his law trumps the law of the land. And telling people that they can't go to church, they can't worship God, they can't sing in church, they have to turn people away from church, is a direct violation of God's law. So I'm very much in support of what those ministers in Canada are doing. And yeah, if I was a police officer over there, I would walk off the job personally, because I couldn't do that in good conscience.
During this latest lockdown in Victoria, the force one overall, we should always point out, the police, Victoria Police response has mainly been focused on, well, their what they would refer to as the known anti-lockdown agitators. There's been, obviously, in 2020, there were a lot of absurd fines handed out that were later rescinded. I think the police commissioner, Shane Patton, said there'd only been about, was it 55 fines that have been issued for, as you said, blatant and flagrant breaches. And we didn't actually have the media conferences this time with either Shane Patton or Luke Cornelius making all sorts of threats, that sort of thing. Though Luke Cornelius did send out letters every Friday night to known anti-lockdown agitators, warning them not to attend rallies. And I'm sure you saw some of the videos there of the local police delivering those letters. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're following orders to use that phrase. But going through those officers' minds, because they're very pleasant to these anti-lockdown activists, who obviously their anger should more be directed at the people at the top rather than the people delivering the mail. But would it be going through their head, like, I didn't sign up for, you know, going around on a Friday night being a delivery boy or girl of letters?
Well, absolutely it would. You know, there are certain things of the job that we don't sign up for. You know, like I have had to do things that will haunt me for the rest of my life. I've, you know, horrible things that you don't want to experience. And I guess delivering these letters is probably like not as extreme as some of the things I mentioned, but it's probably up there in things that you don't really sign up for, you don't want to have to do. But like you just mentioned, if you want to kill a weed, you kill it at the root. You don't just rip off the leaves and then, you know, wait for it to rain for it to grow back again. And, you know, these individual officers can step off the job and do and you know, and quit or refuse to do it. But while ever these people are pulling the strings with what they're doing, the problem's just going to come back. They'll just recruit more police who are just going to follow orders, as opposed to changing the recruitment process, like I said, getting really good operators in there who can use discretion, who can actually think for themselves, and who will actually protect the people as opposed to protecting the government. And I think that's where we get it wrong at the moment. A lot of the policing that we're seeing, especially through COVID, is almost police working against the people when their sole purpose should be to protect the people, not the government. So, yeah.
Also in Victoria, for 19 of the, or when we get to 2022, for 19 of the past 23 years, it's the Labor Party which has been in government, and obviously it's taken a further left turn under the premiership of Dan Andrews, but most of the people appointed police commissioners and judges and to various bodies during that time will obviously be people who align with the centre-left socialist the social justice mindset. And so that's why obviously it all started with Christine Nixon, appointed Victoria Police Commissioner in the early 2000s. And while you have disciples of her, such as, well, Luke Cornelius, again, I mention him because mention him constantly because he was the worst offender when it came to what he said, but also the I always make sure that I want to contribute to him being the most mocked police officer throughout the world, because I think he deserves it.
Yeah, definitely. And this is the thing. I think that police and the government are too intertwined with each other. I think the police need to run incredibly independently from the government for accountability purposes, if nothing else, but to keep the integrity and impartiality. Because as soon as you let politics affect something that should be impartial, something that shouldn't be swayed by emotions or feelings or agenda or narrative, once you incorporate that, then it's corrupted, it's corroded, and you're never going to get the full benefits from it. So I think that there has to be a huge reform, and I'm all for the police operating completely independently from the government to protect the people and to enforce the law properly.
And going further from that, obviously in Victoria, we're seeing both the police and prosecution, Office of Public Prosecutions tend to target for prosecution for various things, nationalist patriots rather than Antifa and other left-wing agitating groups. And selective policing is is what is most suspected. And as I mentioned, it tends to align with how long the Labor Party has been in power there.
Yeah, it's something that you can see around the globe. I mean, if you have a look at some of the sentencing for, you know, juveniles over in America, you've got people, you know, to do with these riots who I guess are sort of looking at a lifetime in prison for something. And then you get those two young girls who ran over that Uber driver. I'm not sure if you remember that. They hijacked the car and he hung out of it and they crashed the car and he died. And it was a terrible crime. They're old enough to know better. The mens rea, which is like the age of criminal capability, is there. They were like teenagers, and they're trialing them as children, whereas other children for other type political agendas are getting trialed as adults. So you're seeing this around the globe. You're seeing it, unfortunately, infect like a plague, all the different law enforcement organizations around the world. But again, something like that isn't actually law enforcement related in particular. That's actually the court system, the judicial system, the criminal justice system. A lot of the time police will bring these people to courts, will charge people with things, and then the court makes these decisions. And unfortunately, it looks like it's a reflection on what law enforcement are doing, when really it's the court system. But the court system, even though they probably have more power than the police, they aren't really held to the same level of accountability, unfortunately.
There's a super chat over on Entropy for $3 Australian from Senator Slay, who says, "Evelyn, you can arrest me any day."
Those days are over. Sorry, mate.
Now, as I mentioned, that it seems that the left, they like the police when they're prosecuting and arresting the people that they hate. And at the federal level, they seem to like ASIO and all these other federal law enforcement spy agencies now, as long as they go after those racist, fascist Nazis. But as we saw earlier this week in your state of New South Wales, the security state can bite the left when a government that they don't like is in power. And I'm sure you saw the footage of Friendly Geordie's producer Crisho being arrested by the New South Wales Counterterrorism and Fixated Persons Unit. Now, I think Friendly Geordie is a vile person with vile politics, but it's especially naive of like the left are now only learning that, oh, like all this security state apparatus, if a government we don't like comes to power, then oh, they can go after us. You hope that they learn from this, but I don't think they will.
Yeah, I think this is part of the leftist sort of ideology. It's like very relativist. It's, you know, and that's why it's so inconsistent. That's why it's so flip-flop. And I think that, you know, when you base your morality and your worldview off a relativist type idea, you're always going to find like the left that it's just going to self-implode. Stupidity can't sustain itself, as I like to say. And I think this is just a classic example. I hope that like what you said, that they'll realize certain things, but their very own way of life and the way that they view the world would suggest probably otherwise.
And as like we've seen, like the way that various powers and funding is sold, where we're going to protect you from, and this is especially the case during COVID. I'm going to just share with the audience, well, one of Cauldron Pool's articles about the WA or COVID Safe app has been accessed by law enforcement because there is a legal avenue for it, even though Mark McGowan said, oh, it's only for contact tracing. That's what all the other apps said. This tracking apparatus, well, it's already, at least in Western Australia, it's already being used in other means, which it wasn't sold to the public that way.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting? I said this from the very start, and this goes back to when Scott Morrison said we need at least 40% of Australians to download the COVID tracing app. I don't know if you remember that. Yes. And he didn't actually say you have to, but he basically did at the same time. It was very clear what he was saying. If 40% of people don't do it, you'll be locked in your homes, but you don't have to. And I remember looking into the app at that particular time, not because I was going to do it myself. I wasn't, but just for, you know, my own, I guess, investigation into it. And I saw a clause in the legal framework saying that police were able to apply for warrants. And I remember not being a police officer, I thought you only like apply for a warrant if you're investigating a crime, those sorts of things. And so I knew a year ago that this particular app had the capability of police being able to, you know, obtain a warrant and get certain information from these apps. And, you know, if I had have said it back then, I probably would have had all my accounts shut down. I think I did mention it sort of vaguely. But again, it was just something that you weren't allowed to talk about, even though it was right there in your face. And if you did talk about it, you were a conspiracy theorist, or, you know, you were a fearmonger, and you know, you were bad news, and you would have got shut down. But here we are. It's here, and it was real. And, you know, people who looked into that, maybe like me, would have seen it and knew that it was capable of happening.
There seems to be a 6 to 12 month lag time now of something that it's called a conspiracy theory at the time, yeah. But then in that later on, it becomes the accepted truth, obviously.
I'm waiting for all my apologies.
Yeah. Well, the Alex Jones was right tip jar, as it's called, is very full.
Oh, yeah. He's set for life.
going to obviously this for law enforcement, this digital surveillance apparatus is attractive from a law, like, because, well, everyone wants to get baddies if it's easier to get them. It's the argument is, well, the ends justify the means. If we're only going to access this person's COVID contact tracing activity. The other thing before was the metadata retention. It was only going to be accessed for these reasons. Well, it was sold. It'll help us to track down child porn users and traffickers. They are abhorrent people. We want them shut down. But then it's more and more agencies get access to it, and the ultimate fear that people have is that there is political agendas in various law enforcement agencies. If they want to target a certain activist or journalist, then it's easy to find out everything about them.
Yeah, and this is another one of those situations where I'm torn. I worked at child sex crimes, so I've seen some of the most horrible things that people should never have to witness in their lifetime. And if it came to using a COVID tracing app to get the murder of an 8-month-old baby that I had to pick up off the floor, I would like, as you said, I would like to take that info and lock that person up for the rest of their existence. But again, I'm conflicted because I think if things were more transparent and there weren't lies or agenda, like you said, and people went into things knowing full well the truth of it and what its potential could be, then I would have no problem with law enforcement using whatever means necessary to lock up legitimate criminals. And I say legitimate criminals because, like you mentioned before, unfortunately, there is a plague of agenda and political narrative that's been getting driven into the criminal justice system. So, I'm conflicted. I think that if the government actually allowed the people to have a conversation and actually had freedom of speech to discuss these sort of things, then the public could make an actual informed decision whether they want to participate in these apps or not, knowing full well what could happen. But it's when it's hidden, when it's sinister, and when it's hiding that I completely understand the distrust in the government and what they're asking.
Now, we're only a third through the topics, though. We've already gone for 45 minutes, probably an hour. So I hope that you're willing to... I'll try to keep the rest of the show succinct, but I hope you can stick around for a bit longer because we're probably going to go over time. But the other aspect of the law that you've been talking about particularly your video with Lauren Southern, she revealed after legal processes had concluded that she was a victim of a creepy groper in a supermarket. And it was interesting when she told the story, like she had she'd obviously thought about something like that could happen and how she might react, but she didn't know how she would react until the moment where she just sort of froze up. But obviously that's the context of the video. But we've had Me Too, and now we've had Me Too 2.0, which began. All these cultural issues tend to flare up when there's a dip in the COVID curve, I think you've noticed. But Brittany Higgins, former Liberal staffer, alleging that she was raped in Parliament House and she didn't get enough support. There was no real follow-up on her accuser. We're at the stage now, that was back in February this year. We don't know the state of the police investigation into a rape. I know that you know who the blue drops are on Twitter who say, oh, the police, they haven't even prosecuted him. Yeah, obviously you wouldn't know how the investigation's going, but it still would be. But what's your analysis been on that situation? Because it's obviously been politically weaponized, very a political issue. The thing that's always got me about it, that Brittany Higgins, for somebody whose dream job was to be a Liberal staffer, she seems to be helping the Labor and the Greens agenda out tremendously.
Yeah, look, I think that particular incident, again, I don't know enough about the inside of that investigation to really form an educated or informed decision on whether, you know, where I sit, whether I think it's legitimate or not. But one thing, like you mentioned as well, is the Me Too movement and the damage that it has done to these due processes. And unfortunately right now, like with this Me Too movement being weaponized with the slogan Believe All Women, it's basically just a campaign that is calling out and shaming individuals for unproven crimes. And unfortunately, there are consequences of that. And I don't think that people who are unfairly sort of accused of something, I don't think that they are ever free of that. I think that being accused of a crime such as rape, even if it's proven that you didn't commit that crime, that's something that you have to carry around for the rest of your life. Because whether people like to admit it or not, like people sort of get seeds planted and there's always that sort of doubt, and victims of false allegations have to carry that burden for the rest of their existence. And this Believe All Me, All Women and Me Too movements, unfortunately, just do a real disservice to actual victims of crime. I've seen it so much in the years that I served. And I can say this with honesty and hand to my heart, in all the years that I served, almost 12, I would have seen equal, if not more, false allegations than legitimate allegations, proven crimes.
Wow. Obviously, yeah. You were alluding to the Christian Porter allegation, which obviously it has been seized upon in the media and on Twitter, obviously because they wouldn't like Christian Porter as a politician, but they'd also want to get the Morrison government as well. But the thing was, this woman who had accused him sadly took her own life. So it can never be proven or disproven, which is a lot of these leftist feminists actually want. They actually hate the legal process of the beyond reasonable doubt, the standard of proof. They claim that that's part of the patriarchy that's keeping women from getting proper justice. I know that she has her flaws, but Bettina Arndt has spoken about this for many years, that the feminists, they want more kangaroo courts where it's easier to not convict, but just declare someone guilty. There was all this talk about having a independent inquiry into Christian Porter, which is a form of kangaroo court. And obviously, from a law enforcement background, any type of kangaroo court is alarming.
Yeah, and it's detrimental to the police investigations. Like, there's no, when it comes to sexual assault, there's no statute of limitations, which means there are historical sexual assaults. And I've had people almost get outraged at me when I've said, I have actually locked up pedophiles 20 years after the crime. People say, that's too long. How can you prove it? There's no evidence. But there's actually a lot of covert type police tactics that are available to detectives. I used many of them. That was my bread and butter. And unfortunately, when it's guilty on assumption and when these, as you said, these sort of side legal processes sort of happen, it actually really affects the legitimacy of the police investigation. It actually hinders the police investigation. And it almost, you're almost like kneecapping us. You're making our job a lot harder. You're making our evidence a lot harder to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, because the standard of proof for criminal matters is beyond a reasonable doubt. If you have a civil matter, it's based on the balance of probability. So there's a different, it's a higher burden of proof. And the reason being is because if you're found guilty of a criminal offense, your liberties, your freedoms are stripped from you. Those rights are gone. And that's a huge thing, because if people don't have their freedoms and rights, what do they have? So I understand how, you know, that the onus on the police is quite high, because it has to be, and it has to maintain that level of integrity so that true justice is actually seen on true offenders. But yeah, these side things really make it our job harder, because we'll go to court and what might have been accepted as evidence and what might have been accepted as something that isn't, you know, declared as hearsay is now hearsay, because they say the witness could have been corrupted by media, or the witness could have been corrupted by other influences. And then that whole evidence is thrown out, and then you're left with nothing and you can't prosecute. And yeah, I think that for the Me Too movement, they claim that, you know, their entire ideology is to help women and to help women get justice, but they actually just making them not get justice. And I don't like the idea that being a survivor is, you know, redundant. It's like they live in constant victimhood, and it's really sad.
Obviously, I can't put myself in the shoes of any sexual assault survivor, so it makes it like difficult to judge each person's individual circumstance. But there are famous examples of famous women who have been subjected to rape or sexual assault. Like, for example, Fran Drescher, who's famous for the Nanny TV sitcom. She was raped during a home invasion early in her career, yet had went on to create one of the funniest sitcoms of all time, and is just a bubbly, optimistic person. Carrie Ann Kenley, she in her first marriage was a victim of domestic violence, but that hasn't defined her career. She's been one of the most extraordinary TV presenters, interviewers as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, I think that the Me Too movement and the Believe All, you know, victims, Believe All Women, it actually just does a disservice to everybody. It does a disservice to women. It does a disservice to men. It does a disservice to the criminal justice system. All it does is demonstrate that society has little regard for fact, and they're largely just emotionally driven. And yeah, like you said, it's sort of, it keeps women in a constant state of victimhood. And I think, you know, to be bold and to be frank, victimhood today equals currency in a lot of ways. And a lot of people are exploiting it, and a lot of people are kind of taking it for a ride. And all it does is step on the toes of the women who actually have been raped and the men who have been raped. And, you know, it puts a fake person in front of them, and it's like, well, how about we look at these people who have gone through that and have survived, who've actually gone through the court process, which is incredibly difficult, and put someone behind bars for 30 years, 40 years, whatever it is, and saved potentially all these other victims. You've got to look at the Me Too movement. You've got to look at the Believe All Women movement, and you have to ask yourself, what good does it actually do? If it did good, if it actually brought justice for victims, if it actually uncovered and unearthed real crimes, which can be proven in court, great. But does it do that? No, it doesn't. What has it done? It's actually made it harder for real victims of crime to want to speak out against it, because real victims of crime don't want to be portrayed as a woman or a man or someone who is just going along with that ride. It does no good for anybody. And I think that the sooner people reject these ideas on guilty on assumption and trial by media, as soon as people reject that and go back to, you know, making police reporting normal and going through the court process and celebrating survivors like the women that you mentioned, that's where real justice is. That's where real progress is. This idea is just regressive. It's just backwards.
With the high profile Me Too, the men accused in Me Too, the only one that comes to mind who's actually behind bars is Harvey Weinstein. Kevin Spacey, none of the allegations ever made it to court. Neither the ones against Roger Ailes, who is now deceased. But obviously Hollywood and media and entertainment, it's not as black and white as it is portrayed now. A lot of women would gladly perform a favor for a male executive if it helped their career. Like, there's obviously, as the saying goes, two to tango. There is that sort of other aspect where women are happy to do things to advance their career. And there's also going to the sexual harassment. Obviously, we've had the Morrison government unveil further reforms about workplace office harassment. But there's also some women who, well, they'd like to be the center of male attention. Was it? I think it got leaked recently. Tina McQueen, who's the Liberal Party vice president, she said at a meeting, "She, I would kill to be sexually harassed." So there's these sort of subjective issues of what constitutes sexual harassment, who's a willing participant. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think something that's really important for people to understand is that regret doesn't equate to consent. And I think that those lines, unfortunately, because of the narrative and the agenda that's being pushed, are being blurred. I think that, you know, the age of responsibility for one's own actions has pretty much ceased to exist. People like to blame everybody else for their problems. People like to be a victim. People don't like to admit their own flaws, their own mistakes, and their own decisions, and the fact that their decisions have consequences. Your actions and your inactions all have consequences. And I think we're in an age where those normal ways to live that people live normally are forgotten. And that's why we're getting in a culture where, you know, those lines are blurred. Regret does not equal consent. There's actually legislation, I think, that they're bringing in potentially in Australia, I think, where part of the proofs of the offence, so I'm not sure if you understand how proofs of the offence work. So if I want to charge somebody with a criminal offence, there might be 10 proofs of that offence. If I can only get 9 out of 10, that's pretty solid that they've probably done it, but I still cannot charge that person because I have to satisfy all 10 proofs of that offense. And not only just 10 proofs of the offense, I have to satisfy each 10 of those proofs of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. So I have to prove who the accused person is. Like, I have to 100% be confirm their identity beyond a reasonable doubt. I have to 100% confirm, you know, the act that they did. There's no doubt in it. And it's a really hard process. And, I think that I've lost my train of thought here a little bit. I've gone off on a tangent. But, yeah, I think that – sorry, go again.
I'm supposed to say that people followed the Bible, particularly when it comes to sexuality, all these problems wouldn't be so prevalent.
Not a, I think if people that's right, I remember, sorry. I'm like, this is like past my bedtime, so I'm a bit slow. I apologize. I remember what I was saying, legislation. So they bring it in for sexual assault that now men and women have to show and prove that they sought consent. So how does that transpire practically? Because me as a police officer, I'm like, well, what does that mean? Do men and women have to sign a piece of paper, like make like a blood oath and like spit and like shake hands on it? Yep, we agree to do this. Do people have to start wearing cameras, GoPros, wherever they go, just so that they can prove in court if a false allegation ever comes out, they can prove, no, hang on, let me just pull up my recording from, 3 weeks ago. Or hang on, here's a piece of paper in my wallet I signed. We spat, we pinpricked blood here. Here you go. I think it's just this day and age, like, don't have sex till you're married because potentially you are going to get locked up.
The best, what is it, form of documentation when it comes to, well, sexual consent is a marriage contract certificate.
Yeah, that's true. And get everybody just needs to get a GoPro and let everybody know I'm recording this, so there's nothing weird, but this is for my protection and stuff, because that's how sad it's becoming, this idea of Me Too and believe all women and people not taking responsibility for their actions and not wanting to, have to deal with their consequences and things like that. This is the world that we're living in.
I think that's a good segue into, well, talking about the Cauldron Pool, which the website that you're a contributor for, which, well, in my opinion, it's risen quite quickly to, well, the probably the most popular, as I said, unapologetically culturally Christian conservative website. It began in 2017, and well, the first big cultural battle that it covered was the same-sex marriage postal survey, which, despite the fact that, well, Tony Abbott was headbutted by Yes Voter, the ACL officers were car bombed. Yes Vote still won overwhelmingly, and same-sex marriage is the law of the land. And we've seen, well, on the gender and sexuality issue, that all the culture issues that Cauldron Pool has fought against, not just same-sex marriage, but, well, the gender fluid birth certificates, the conversion therapy bans, they've all gone the way of the progressive. Same with life issues. All the states and territories are going down like flies when it comes to abortion and euthanasia legislation. It seems like your side is losing everything at the moment. Sure, obviously, Cauldron Pool provides a rallying cry and to disenfranchise Christian conservatives, but if you look at the political scoreboard, it's not looking good.
Yeah, it depends on how you look at it. So if we get out of the bubble of Australia, and we just get out of like the bubble of like the West, if you actually look at statistics, I think Christianity is 31% of the whole world are Christians at the moment.
Are
And it
they
started with
Christians in, well, the Cauldron Pool worldview? Because as we've seen in Australia, there's a lot of people who call themselves Christians but would support all the culture war issues that Cauldron Pool poses, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I was trying to say is if it depends on how you look at it. So if you're looking at Christianity as a whole, it started off with 12 disciples and now we're at 30, 31% of the whole world's population identifies as Christian. Whether that means they are Christian or not, they're identifying as it. But sort of what you were sort of touching on with this cultural within Australia and the things, like if you're looking at a tally of, you know, what we're winning and what we're not winning, I think it comes down to how we define Christian conservative. And you almost need to make a distinction between Christians and conservatives, because not all conservatives are Christian. And I think that's
Conservatives. I mean, Christina Keneally calls herself a Catholic. She's not very conservative.
Yeah, and so does Biden, yet he look at his sort of, you know, he says he's Catholic and then he is for abortion, which is one of the biggest things that Catholics, you know, push against, as well as Christians. But, you know, I think a lot of people that call themselves Christians are probably people that call themselves conservatives are more likely economically conservative, but probably socially liberal, if that makes sense. So I think
as classical liberals, that's sort of more the term.
Yeah, I think it's relativism with nostalgia. So, I mean, a lot of the problem what we're seeing today, I believe personally, is the fact that the Christian conservative has become very watered down. It's very dilute. I think that sort of the mouthpiece and sort of the front, what people are seeing, are not actually Christian conservatives. It's more likely economically conservative with a more liberal social type outlook. So that's why you're seeing Christians voting for same-sex marriage and Christians voting for late-term abortions, because, you know, I think the true Christian conservative has become very diluted and almost apologized or made room for things that are not actually Christian conservative by nature. But I think... the problem that we're facing is, no matter how many laws you introduce, no matter what you do, you know, you might hold off something for a small amount of time, but if you want to actually make change, you have to change the hearts of people, because laws aren't going to, like, as I said, you can put laws in place to stop things from happening.
Culture.
Say again, sorry?
Politics is downstream from culture, as they say.
Yeah, so I think... I don't necessarily think that Christians are losing, so to speak, but what I do think could be happening, like, is this a time where we're losing, or is this a time where we're going to be having a revival? Because I don't know about you, but I'm seeing all around the world at the moment, people are looking for something else. People are going, okay, this world that we're living in is no longer working, you know, and they're looking, they're seeking for something to give them a higher purpose. They're seeking for a worldview that kind of aligns to that nostalgia of the 1950s. People look at the 1950s with the heroes that went to war. People look at the 1950s with the idea of family and, you know, the idea of that safety and those sorts of things. And they want that. And they don't really know why they want that, but they have this relativist nostalgia towards that. And if you have a look around, it's happening everywhere. And I think that personally, it's only a matter of time before the left lose, because by the very nature and ideology of the West, they can't sustain themselves. It's like the snake eating the tail of the snake. They just are going to keep self-imploding and eating themselves until there's nothing left. And you know, it's like any shakeup. If there's an earthquake, the things that are strong, the things that are sturdy, they're going to stay on the shelves. They're going to stay planted where they were put. And at the moment, I feel like we are on the verge of a revival. Like, we're getting shaken up, and it is sort of exposing the fake Christians and making room for the strong conservative Christians who are going to be unapologetic with what they think with their politics, and it's going to bring people in. It would appear that, you know, we're losing, but I have hope that we're not. That's my greatest prayer in life, that we can make a better world for our kids. This one's not too good at the moment.
I know that Cauldron Pool was involved in a beef with another Christian website. You would know which one it is. I don't want to get the name wrong, but they didn't like that Cauldron Pool was so polarizing on the Christian message.
Yeah, look, you're going to get people everywhere who don't like hearing the truth. That's the unfortunate part about it. People, people want to believe something that makes them feel good, not necessarily what the truth is. And it was Eternity News, by the way.
Yes, I thought it was. I just didn't want to name it wrong.
Yeah, and look, without getting into the nitty gritty of it, like if I was just to generalize it, I would say that people who aren't really doing the right thing like to attack others who are doing the right thing. And, you know, everybody has their own theology. Everybody has their own, like, doctrines and things that they live by. But there were lots of people that were attacked by, you know, Eternity News. Lots of people that were sort of named, so to speak, publicly about certain things. And I think it comes down to a reflection on the hearts of the people who wrote it and not necessarily what the truth of everything is.
And now, as you just said before, obviously to win over hearts and minds, that's just as important, if not more important than politics. And I know Mark Niles of the Australian Christian Lobby has got here's the truth of it tour. Dave Pellow has his annual church and state summit, which there is still the ACL is a lobby group, and well, as the name suggests, church and state, it's about how Christians should interact with government. So there is obviously the need to be politically active as well, but both major parties have indicated in recent times that Christians with those beliefs, they don't want them in the party. I mean, the Labor Party, when they basically made Joe Bullock from WA quit as a senator because they made his conservative values just so unwelcome. And there was the recent report about Christians being denied membership in the South Australian Liberal Party on Cauldron Pool. There was an article about a Christian church in Gippsland accused of branch stacking the National Party. There's in both major parties, if all there's these people that join, they're from some church, it's a branch stack, and they're going to put up extreme candidates who are going to make us lose the election.
Yeah, I always I find it interesting that, you know, there's people in politics from all walks of life. You have people in Australia who are Muslim who are in politics. You have people who are, you know, atheists. You have people who, you know, you name it. There's somebody from somewhere, but it would appear, and I'm not sure if you see that, there's a constant attack on Christian conservatives, especially Christian conservatives that want to have a foot in the door of politics. And I always ask the question, what makes those people's morality or their ultimate form of authority greater than mine as a Christian? Because, you know, as an atheist or someone who is, you know, Muslim, like they obviously get their morality from their theology, which is their understanding of God and nature and life. I get my understanding of theology from my Christian God. Why is where I get mine from any less than where they get theirs from? Why is it okay for them to do it but not me? Is this an attack on Christianity? Is this an attack on my God? Because you can't say that as a white Christian woman. I can't say those things, but if I was Muslim, I could say it. And so you've got to look at the disparity between the two. You've got to look at the discrepancies. You have to look at how there are two sets of rules, unfortunately, in a world that's apparently supposed to be for equal rights. And that's the part that upsets me the most about the debate, is when people tell me with church and state basically that I'm not allowed to be involved in politics because I'm a Christian. I'm like, well, what makes your opinion better than mine? Why is your ultimate form of authority? I use the Bible to guide my view on morality. That's what I like, the Ten Commandments on God's law in the Bible. That's what I base who I am as a person on, my morality, my outlook on life. You base yours off a relativist worldview, what the majority think, what this, why is that greater than mine? Why don't I get to have a voice here as well? Why am I being discriminated against? It's like because our very own way of life is to love our neighbor regardless of what their sins are, you know, like I have to love my neighbor. I'm commanded to love my neighbor. And it's like, because they know that by our own ideology, we have to, you know, love them and be kind to them and show the fruits of the spirit, you know, towards them. They can almost use it and weaponize it against us. And it's like, well, we can do that. But do you see people doing that against other religions, against Allah? Can you imagine if the things that they did to Christianity, they did to that? Well, you don't have to imagine. Have a look in France, the beheadings recently. Like, you can just see the difference between the two, and it's almost weaponized against us. And to be honest, like, it's infuriating as a Christian to kind of not have a voice or be told your voice doesn't matter because you believe in a fairy god. Well, it's like, well, you don't believe in one. You believe in humanity, and humanity sucks. Humanity by its very nature is corrupt and not good. Why do you think people know better? And yeah, so it's challenging at times to watch it happen.
Well, we've had a great discussion on all aspects of, well, law enforcement and the culture war. I might just finish that. I put the question to you that, well, why are you losing the culture war? But obviously, I mean, Melbourne, we're in we've been in a dark period for more than a year. The past year has only turbocharged it. And there's people who say, well, a year of railing against the COVID restrictions and continuing lockdown and health fascism, what have you achieved? But what? Poland, Hungary, Eastern Europe, they suffered under 44 years of communism before they were able to reach the revival that they're in now. It's not instantaneous, and I'm sure that sort of lesson of history would keep your faith going as well. You don't overturn a cultural decline or a police state or totalitarianism in 6 to 12 months, unfortunately.
No, and that's the thing. I think people have fallen in love with their comforts more than their freedoms. So at the moment, people are so desperate to, you know, have their comforts. I want to have a job. I want to, you know, be able to walk freely to the supermarket. I need these comforts. They're not willing to sacrifice their comforts in order to fight for their overall freedom and their long-term freedom. But there will come a point in time when, if we continue down this path, the government will just take those comforts from them anyway, and they'll be left with no choice but to fight for their freedom. I just hope that people recognize that they might have to sacrifice their short-term comforts now and push back more now and be more unapologetic now, so that they can have these long-term freedoms and they don't have to get to a point where there is like a civil war. There is some sort of mass rebellion where there are lives lost because of fighting and whatnot. Like, if you look at history, as you said, I hope that these generations, like our generation and the new generations, like, we need some really strong people to, you know, grassroots movement, start local, take back your schools, take back your businesses, take back like the boards of whatever sporting event you have, like in your local kids soccer team, whatever it is, take it back, make the effort now, pull your finger out, because these short-term comforts are just that, they're short-term, and we kind of need to fight for it now so that we can maintain our long-term freedoms. I said this in a video not too long ago, maybe a week ago, that it's like people are sitting on the edge of the beach, like on the shore, waiting for these waves of freedom to come and sit on their lap, like crash on their lap. But they don't realize that freedom naturally gravitates away from government. The bigger the government, that we have, the less freedom we are going to have. And you actually have to jump in the water. You actually have to swim upstream against the current to fight for the freedom before the government takes it from you. That's the nature of it. It doesn't naturally gravitate towards us. We have to fight for it. And it's going to take all of us to realize that to actually move forward and fight and win this war.
They're going to want more and more governments going forward. I'm still skeptical of, they say, the best way to get back to normal is just take the vaccine. But they've moved the goalposts so many times.
I know. As with,
it doesn't protect you from infection of COVID. So, are they going to come good on this? Or if enough people are vaccinated, go back to normal? Are they going to dismantle the QR check-ins everywhere? There's still a lot to unfold and a lot at stake.
Yeah, I think something to remember is the government take a lot easier than they give back. And that's why I've said from the very start, precedent is so important. People are like, just 14 days. It's just this. I'll just get a COVID test because, I sneezed once, I better do this. But precedent is so important because once the precedent is set, the government knows what they can do. And they've essentially taken something from you that they can use against you. And yeah, the government doesn't give these things back. That's why we're looking in Victoria, how they're looking now to make these permanent lockdown legislation. So it's gone from having an impartial, semi-impartial, non-corrupted system where the health minister and the premier have to apply to the courts to get these health orders enacted and legislated for certain time periods. And there's accountability measures with that where, every 12 weeks they have to go back to court and either reapply to extend these health sort of things, or whether
and I think with most states and territories, they seem to just have just unilaterally done the health orders. Mm. The courts have just rubber stamped all of the health orders to date.
Yeah, absolutely. But you can see how the precedent was set. We've allowed it, and this is why it's happening. And now they're looking to have it permanently. So this process isn't even going to be there anymore. Well,
20 years after 9/11, we're still living under the national security measures that were enacted post 9/11 and the war on terror. So
that's right.
There's the precedent from that period.
Yeah, and if you actually have a look at the public health acts of each state, most of them were enacted in 1956 or 1970. So this legislation has been around for a long, long time. And now it's relevant in 2020. So it's like, if all this legislation is coming in now, sure, we might go COVID's over and it's not going to affect us. But what's going to happen in 20 years when our kids go through a bird flu or some other COVID 73.0? Who knows? These things are going to be there once it's enacted. The precedent is set. And yeah, the government will not give it back as easy as they take it.
And people who want to see more of your commentary and vlogs, you're on, for now, Facebook, Twitter, but you've also set up a Telegram, and you're also on Gab as well?
Yeah, Telegram, Gab, and Instagram. But I'm probably most active, I would say, on Twitter. Facebook have censored me and shadow banned me a long time ago. I've given up on that almost. I post just, for the few that might have me sort of on notifications, maybe the 2 out of the 9,000.
You're shows one
of the 2. Thank you.
And of course, for people to see you on InfoWars, because that has been deplatformed, yet I have to go to, Infowars.com and see you on Paul Murray Live, Sky News, and your regular content at Cauldron Pool, which is just cauldronpool.com.
Yeah, I'd say, Cauldron Pool is where my heart is. It's where I, will be publishing most of my written articles, and that's probably the best place to find stuff like that. Yeah, video content. Whoever will have me on, like you.
It's been a pleasure to have you on, Wilmsfront. Take care. I myself don't know whether I'm going to stay in Victoria. I don't have the sort of life where I can just sort of like pack up and leave like some sort of gypsy, but it ain't getting any better here.
Yeah.
New South Wales seems to be where, well, there seems to be the most sort of like-minded, sane people.
Yeah, yeah. I think if Victorians don't get out, like, God bless you, because you're going to need it. I think we're happy to take asylum seekers to New South Wales if you want to come, Tim. That's fine. Yeah. We'll.
I'd be prepared to sign a values statement or do some sort of like statehood test. I'm sure I'd pass it.
Yes, yes, definitely. No, you should come. I think Victoria is a long way to getting better, and it almost seems futile, the efforts that people are putting in down there. I mean, I'd like to say stay and fight, but also at the same time, you can fight from anywhere. And if you want to be safe, maybe it's wise to get out when you can.
Well, the songs that sum up Victoria at the moment are, what is it, Highway to Hell, Hotel California, Road to Nowhere, and We've Got to Get Out of Place if it's the last thing we ever do.
Fantastic. That's brilliant. Yeah, very accurate.
Thanks to everyone in the live chat for interacting. Often the live chat takes on a life of its own. As per the current schedule, the Wilmsfront featured interview show will return in a fortnight. My next guest will be Kyle Kutazi, where we're going to go through the end of financial year statements of governments, which are also horrendous. I'll be back on Monday with Tim's News Explosion, 8:30 p.m. Melbourne time on the Wilmsfront channels. And then next week, it's the Trad-Tasman Talk Week On, which is 6 p.m. Melbourne time on the Unshackled YouTube channel and Trad-Tasman Talk Odyssey. That's another platform that you should get on. A proper YouTube alternative, Odyssey, is amazing. And, of course, the unshackled.net's got our Unshackled Productions archive and also our written content as well. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching. I'll see you on Monday for Tim's News Explosion, as I said, and another fortnight for Wilmsfront. Good night. Everybody, please stay safe, stay well, and stay optimistic.
Thanks for tuning in to Wilmsfront. Visit timwilms.com or Rational Rise TV to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis.